Hi, and welcome to this week's Expert HR podcast with me, Ellie Gelder. Now, it's a topic that sparked a flurry of headlines last year, women having to wear high heels in the workplace. It followed the case of Nicola Thorpe, who was sent home from work without pay because of her failure to comply with a policy that required women to wear high heels. And the case prompted a government inquiry. As part of the inquiry, the Women and Equalities Commission recently published a report on high heels and dress codes. And just this week, MPs have been debating the issue of dress codes, in particular those that are sexist. I'm joined now by Principal Employment Law Editor Stephen Simpson, who's going to discuss some of the dangers of having an overly prescriptive dress code. And we'll also have a look at how the courts and tribunals have dealt with dress codes over the years. But first things first, Stephen, there are no specific UK laws on dress codes, are there?
That's right. So there's no specific laws or enforceable statutory codes of practice on dress codes in the workplace. I think that's one of the things that makes dress codes a difficult area for employers.
Okay, so just remind us which laws are applicable then when it comes to dress codes.
So the main legislation is, of course, the Equality Act 2010, where the direct discrimination provisions and even more so the indirect discrimination provisions come into play. There are 9 protected characteristics under the Act, one of which, of course, is sex.
And the key concept for direct discrimination is less favourable treatment, isn't it?
Yes, so that's where the individual is less favourably treated because of protected characteristics such as sex. Direct discrimination cannot be justified, and while there is a defence if the employer can show that there is a genuine occupational requirement for a dress and appearance rule, that defence is notoriously narrow and will hardly ever allow for a blanket rule on appearance.
But the more dangerous claim for employers is indirect discrimination, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I'm sure listeners will all be familiar with the concept of indirect discrimination. But just a reminder that this is where a rule is applied across the board that puts people with the protected characteristics such as sex at a particular disadvantage compared with others who don't share the characteristic.
But importantly, there is a justification defence for indirect discrimination.
Yes, again, this is a concept that listeners will be familiar with, but it's always worth repeating. The dress rule can be justified if it's a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim.
And there's clearly the potential for sex discrimination in dress code rules. So can you just give us some examples?
So the examples that came up most commonly in the government's recent report and inquiry are requiring women to wear makeup or high heels, or a requirement for women to wear a skirt.
So what are the key cases here?
So a key historical case is Schmidt and Oystick's Bookshops Limited, which is a 1977 case in which a female bookshop worker was required to wear a skirt and banned from wearing trousers while serving the public. She was dismissed after she refused to wear a skirt.
And did that requirement constitute sex discrimination?
So it's a judgment that seems very surprising to us 40 years on, but the Employment Appeal Tribunal found that the bookshop did not commit direct sex discrimination.
So why was that?
So the rationale was that it's okay for employers to have a gender-specific rule as long as there are comparable rules of conventional dress for both sexes. For example, in this case, there were also rules for men who weren't allowed to wear T-shirts. So the EAT accepted there were similar rules for both sexes.
So that's quite an old case. Is that still good law?
Incredibly, yes. It was affirmed in a 1996 Court of Appeal decision, Smith and Safeway, and there hasn't been a decision at a higher level since.
Okay, so what was the issue in Smith and Safeway?
So in that case, the issue was hair length. A male delicatessen worker with long hair brought a sex discrimination claim after he was dismissed because his ponytail grew too long to be kept under his hat.
And what were Safeway's rules on hair length then?
So the rule for male staff was tidy hair not below shirt collar length, no unconventional hairstyles or colouring. The rule for female staff was tidy hair, shoulder length hair must be clipped back, no unconventional hairstyles or colouring.
And the Court of Appeal found that those rules were comparable and therefore not discriminatory.
Exactly. So the Court of Appeal found that it wasn't discriminatory for employers to require a conventional appearance, even if the rules are slightly different for men and women.
But what if there are rules for women, but no comparable rules for men? Have we got any examples from case law on that?
So the best one I could find was Stoke-on-Trent Community Transport and Creswell, which is a 1994 case that went to the EAT.
And what happened in that case?
So there, a female charity worker began going to work wearing trousers, but she was told by her manager that this was frowned upon. She continued to go to work wearing trousers and was eventually dismissed despite her protests that she needed to because of a medical condition and that she couldn't afford to buy skirts for the office.
And was she found to have been discriminated against?
Yes, so in that case, the claimant won. That was because the employer didn't have any comparable rules for men. There was evidence that men who worked for the charity were allowed to adapt their dress for their comfort. So that was clearly an example of direct sex discrimination.
So a warning there, then, to employers that they must have comparable rules for men and women. But all of the cases we've mentioned are obviously quite old now. So the question many employers are going to be asking is, can any of these cases still be relied on?
So though they are technically still good law, there are reasons why I'd be very cautious as an employer about relying on these cases. Judges will consider cases on the basis of the social norms of the time, and employers shouldn't just assume that because a judge found in 1977 that women could be prevented from wearing trousers and required to wear a skirt, that a judge in 2017 will have come to the same conclusion. And the same goes, I think, for men having long hair.
And are there any other limits to these old cases?
Yes, so the claims all revolved around direct sex discrimination, and the cases did not deal with the issue of indirect sex discrimination.
So let's move on then to indirect sex discrimination. What's the most likely justification for a rule that potentially indirectly discriminates against one sex?
So the most likely justification is normally health and safety, but it's hard to see any health and safety justification that a tribunal would take seriously in relation to any of the gender-specific rules that we've mentioned, such as women wearing makeup, high heels, or a skirt.
Yes, I can't imagine there would be. But what about other possible justifications? So maybe a company wants to project a particular image.
So I think employers are getting into murky territory here. While there's nothing to stop an employer from putting in its dress code that employees must project, say, a positive and professional image, the problems can occur when the dress code is overly prescriptive.
So just give us an example then of a case where an employer has attempted to use projecting a particular image as a justification for a dress rule.
So the best example I can think of was the high-profile case, Ouida and others, and United Kingdom.
So why is that case important? Because wasn't that a big religious discrimination claim?
Yes, it was religious discrimination, but I think this case is important to mention because of the justification related to the corporate image put forward by British Airways.
Okay, just remind us what happened in Ouida.
There, a Christian employee of British Airways was sent home after she came to work displaying a cross on her necklace. The airline's uniform policy banned the wearing of visible items of jewellery. While she lost her religious discrimination case in the UK Court of Appeal, she succeeded when the case went to the European Court of Human Rights.
And what did the European Court say?
So the European Court said that the UK Court of Appeal had not struck a fair balance between the employee's desire to manifest her religious beliefs and the employer's wish to project a certain corporate image.
Why did the European Court come to that conclusion then?
So it wasn't really impressed with British Airways' failure to provide previous examples of staff wearing authorised religious clothing such as turbans having any negative impact on the company's brand or image. It also took into account the discreet nature of the item, which it didn't think detracted from the employee's professional appearance.
So that's a good example of the need to project a certain corporate image not being a sufficient justification for a discriminatory rule. Are there any other strong arguments for a claimant bringing a sex discrimination claim over a makeup, high heels or skirt requirement?
So I think a claimant could play up two aspects. Firstly, these requirements can clearly place women at a particular disadvantage. For example, high heels have been linked to health problems such as musculoskeletal disorders. And then second, there's a strong argument that makeup, high heels and skirt requirements sexualise the presentation of female staff and are demeaning to female staff as well.
And do you have any real life examples of that?
Yes, so the recent Women in Equalities Committee report included some pretty compelling testimony that female staff required to conform to that type of appearance are at increased risk of harassment from customers. So I think that's a good example from real life.
So just give us a flavour then of that testimony.
So one individual who worked in retail and as a receptionist explained that her retail employer encouraged her and female colleagues to wear shorter skirts at Christmas time when a higher proportion of male shoppers was anticipated. Just a quote from her evidence briefly, she said, "I certainly did get a lot of unwanted attention. I was asked out on dates by customers and they wanted to know when I finished my shift. That was uncomfortable."
Given the expectations as to the way women dress at work can clearly cause problems like this, why haven't there been more recent cases on dress codes?
So unfortunately, all areas of employment law, not just sex discrimination, now have the same problem of tribunal fees putting off claimants who could potentially bring test claims. Quite often, the amount of likely compensation just won't justify the paying of £1,200 for a case to go all the way to a tribunal.
So fees are simply making it unfeasible for most workers to bring dress code claims.
Exactly, even if an individual is brave enough to embark on a long and costly tribunal claim, the chances of an employer being forced to change its dress code are slim. Tribunal powers for making recommendations to employers are very weak and rarely invoked.
Does the report contain any recommendations to remedy that?
So there are some interesting recommendations in the report, including giving tribunals the power to use injunctions in employment cases.
So in the context of dress codes, a tribunal could grant an interim injunction to prevent the employer from enforcing a particular rule on its staff.
Yes, the report highlights that the average length of time for sex discrimination cases to be decided is 28 weeks, and at the moment, employers can continue to enforce the rule while the case is ongoing.
So do you think the use of interim injunctions would work?
So it's a good idea on paper, but there would be some major problems, I think, not least employees and unions using the threat of an injunction tactically, for example, as a way to disrupt the employer's business.
Did the report contain any other recommendations?
So the other really interesting suggestion is changing the Equality Act to define exactly what legitimate aims can be.
So what are the suggested legitimate aims?
So the report proposes four. Firstly, health and safety. Secondly, to establish a truly necessary public image. Thirdly, to project a smart and uniform image. And fourthly, to restrict dresses or insignia that may cause offence.
So do you think that could work by changing the law?
Well, I think it would provide some certainty for employers. The biggest danger is that employers could use the list as a tick box exercise and assume that one or more of the aims applies in their case without really thinking it through. So realistically, a change to make legitimate aims more prescriptive is simply not going to happen.
So just to conclude, what can an employer do if they're concerned that their dress code policy is leaving them open, potentially, to a sex discrimination claim?
A good starting point is to take their dress code policy and highlight any specific rules, considering whether or not each rule is really necessary, and if the rule places one gender at a particular disadvantage. Perhaps the most helpful practical part for employers of the Women and Equalities Committee report is a detail of Portico's dress code, both before and after the code was reviewed and after Nicola Thorpe received widespread publicity.
So well worth employers reading that part of the report then?
Yes, I wouldn't normally recommend that employers read such a lengthy parliamentary report, but the case study on how Portico amended its policy is well worth reading. The report contains the full text of Portico's policy, both before and after it was reviewed, and the company scrapped its very detailed gender-specific policy, covering everything from shade of nail varnish to height of heels, and moved to a more general, adaptable policy that's suitable for 2017.
Thanks, Stephen. So certainly some essential reading for those of you who are wondering whether or not you should be adapting your dress code policy. For more information on dress codes, have a look at our task on establishing a workplace dress code, where you can see all our relevant content in one place. That brings us to the end of this week's Expert HR podcast, which you've been listening to with me, Ellie Gelder. We'll be back next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.